Hello and thanks once again for taking the time to download and listen to a podcast on CelticUnderground.net. I am Harry Brady and this is podcast number 232. This week I'm just the editor. I'm taking a break from chatting with people and replaced by St. Anthony, who is speaking with journalist, best man to Jim Baxter, and editor of the famous Playing for Celtic annuals, Mr. Roger Bailey. So, without further ado, this is me, Harry Brady, saying I'll speak to you later, and this is him, St. Anthony, with him, Roger Bailey.
Pleasure tonight to be able to speak to experienced journalist Roger Bailey, and we're going to recall some of his memories during a long career in the press trade. But as always on the site, what we're going to ask you, Roger, what was your first football game you attended and who would have been your first football hero?
Well, first football match was Rangers about 1952, I think, that I can recall. But in fact, where I stayed was nearer to Thurlanet's ground at Cathkin. So I actually saw much more of Thurlanet than any other team. And they had some wonderful players, including Jimmy Mason, who was the Scotland inside right at the position at the time, and really a very clever player.
Mm-hmm. And would he have been your first hero then,
the
first guy
you admired? Yes, I think he probably was. He was a small player in the great tradition of Scottish inside forwards. Mm-hmm. And he had played a key role in the 1949 victory which Scotland had against England.
At Wembley.
Known as Jimmy Cowan's Wembley, because he was the Morton goalkeeper who had a wonderful game. But Mason played inside right to Willie Waddle in a forward line, which I think I can possibly still recall if my memory goes. It was Waddle Rangers, Mason Thurlanet, Hulston Queen of the South. There wasn't very many Queen of the South. Billy Steele of Derby County and Laurie Riley of Hibs. He was really a striker for Hibs, or centre forward, but played on the left wing for Scotland for a spell.
And would you have watched that game, or would you have heard it on the radio?
No, I did. I heard it on the radio, believe it or not. No, I was 9 years of age at the time. Yes, I remember being taken by an aunt to a tea room and or a cafe or whatever it was, and the radio was on and people were sitting in complete silence listening to it.
So how that came about then, that you became a journalist?
I don't think I'm doing very good at anything else. But I started in the old Glasgow Evening News as a copy boy, which was as a glorified office boy, in March 1956. And 11 months later, the paper closed, so I didn't last very long there. But fortunately, it was the same group as the Record, and I became a copy boy in the Record. Then I became a junior sub-editor. I always fancied doing sport. I always wanted to do sport. I used to do match reports for various outlets until in 1959 I went on to sport as a writer.
And who would have been your contemporaries at that time then? On the Record, for example?
Oh, well, I was the youngest by a country mile. I was 19. There was an old guy called Waverley, Willie Gallagher, who was the number one writer.
Was Rex the Daily Record?
You know, Rex was the Sunday Mail. And Jim Roger, who was a kind of news gatherer. There was a guy called... there was John McPhail,
former Celtic player.
They were the ones in Glasgow, and then the writers in Edinburgh, Dundee and Aberdeen, staff writers. Rex was Bob Kingsley, he was very kind to me. I can't can't say the same for Waverley.
Well, how did they get these sort of pseudonyms?
Well, I think there was it was a throwback from the 30s. Mm. And even before then, no writer actually appeared under his own byline.
So was this to protect anonymity?
I don't know, Stephen, what it was. It's an interesting question that I've never thought. I think it was just... it was just there. I mean, some of the names were outlandish beyond belief. I remember looking at an old paper once. There was the pseudonym was Bedouin, B-E-D-O-U-I-N. How the heck you work that out? I've no idea.
So you were very fortunate to come along at that period, because this was the great period of Scottish football. You know, the clubs began to have great runs in Europe, and I would imagine you even visited a lot of nice places in your time.
Oh yes.
The Scotland team was doing well, getting to World Cup finals, and then we still had the biannual pilgrimage to Wembley at that time. So this must have been a fantastic experience for a young man at that time.
Very much so. Well, I mean, I didn't go on all of these glamour things you do when you start. But the first trip I did make was, first foreign trip I did make was to Hungary in 1962. Dunfermline, who were the cup winner in the Cup Winners' Cup, they were the cup holders, and they played Újpest Doza in Budapest, and Jock Steen was the manager, and that was really the start of a very nice friendship that I had with him. He was kind to me. I mean, I called him Mr. Steen. I wouldn't have called him Jock in a month of Sundays. But then, in 1963, I moved to the Sunday Mirror as their Scottish correspondent, and that's when I started getting a lot more trips, all the Scotland international trips. And but the first Scotland international trip I went on, we went to Norway and lost 4-3. Guinness lost on a hat trick. Then we went to Ireland. Now, the Republic in those days were really
mediocre.
And we lost 1-0 there. And then we went to Spain in the Bernabeu and won 6-2. I thought that was the way it always worked.
That's a famous win. I think Dennis Law scored 4 goals in that game. Something similar.
No, I don't think so. I remember Billy McNeil played right back. It was unusual. Ian Ewer of Dundee was the centre half.
So, obviously, were you in Lisbon, I would imagine?
Yes, indeed.
And looking back on it, that must have been a tremendous adventure as well.
It was indeed. It was I was in every... I saw every round apart from the first one, which was Zurich. For some reason I didn't. In fact, I think it was with Rangers and playing Glen Torren in the Cup Winners' Cup. That. Anyway, it doesn't matter. But yes, it was all. And to this day, I look back on it as even in 2015, I look back on it as the kind of greatest achievement I think I've ever seen. I don't think it was the greatest achievement I've ever seen. I was very fortunate because the summer before, the Sunday Mirror sent me on a trip with Celtic, 5 weeks in
America. Yeah, yeah.
Again, that would never be, will never be repeated again. We started off, not to give you a National Geographic tour, but we started off in Bermuda, we went to New York, Toronto, back to New York, St. Louis.
You've travelled in the official party with the players,
San Francisco, Vancouver, back to San Francisco, and then Los Angeles.
My God.
5 weeks, 11 games, and there was only 3 of us on the trip. Three press on myself, Ken Gallagher of the Record, and John McKenzie of the Express. And we were included in everything. The pub were very good, and it was wonderful because that was really the test tube games that started the Lions. Jock had various ideas that he tried out on that.
But one of the things I was going to bring up there was that you had a fairly serious accident in the swimming pool on one of those trips. How did that come about?
That came about because, to my shame at the time, I was 25, I think, and I couldn't swim, but I had a cine camera, and in St. Louis, there was all around the pool, and and Tommy Gemmell said to me, Roger, let's have a look at that camera of yours. That's what you did. And the next thing I knew was I was filming as I glugged down just about three times into the pool, and Sean Fallon, God rest his soul, jumped in to rescue me. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying I would have drowned, but
I wasn't doing too well. What about the cine film then? Where would that be these days?
I've got it in the loft sometime. Mm-hmm. Some place in the loft. Mm-hmm. And it's one of these things that you always mean to do, and I've always meant to get it put onto DVD to see what it was like.
And did you film the games or just
just
behind the scenes?
Just behind the scenes. Mm-hmm. No. It was purely a kind of recreational thing.
Uh-huh. That's maybe something that you should contact the club, because you know, these things are, as I was talking to you earlier there, this is history, you know, what we're talking about these days.
Yes, yes, I suppose. There actually was a guy I haven't heard of him for years and years. I don't know if he's still alive, Bill Buckler. And he was at some of the trip and did some of the things. Mm. Because I did a commentary for it when we came back. Mm. But whatever happened to it, I don't know. There was a Celtic film club.
Yeah, that season was the season where Jimmy Gordon filmed the team, never thinking for a minute that they were going to win everything in sight.
That's right.
And it was a bit of a coincidence that, you know, the season that they chose was the greatest of all seasons.
Exactly. Now, I don't know if that organisation is still going, or mm-hmm. may well be.
Mm-hmm. You must have had in terms of getting close to the players, you must have had a shared sense of achievement when they won it in Lisbon.
Yes, very much. Yeah, yes, of course, very much. So, and most of them were about my age too at the same time, so you have an affinity with them. And of course there was, having been with them, as I say, in America and every game apart from Zurich, yes, very much an affinity.
Mm-hmm. And when was the first time that you actually realised that they can win this? Because the reason why I asked this is my dad always talks about the Voisvodina game, mm-hmm. and the very last minute when Billy McNeil scored the winning goal.
From the Charlie Gallagher.
And he says he recalls not being able to sleep that night with excitement, because he honestly felt that fate was going to decree that they were going to go all the way, because that up until then it was an adventure.
That's
but
right.
At that point there was a serious thought that, oh my God, we can win this.
I must say your father's got a greater faith than I have. I'm not saying I didn't think they wouldn't win it, but it just seemed such an impossible dream. Mm. No British team had ever got to the final. Certainly the nearest was Scottish team was Rangers in 1960, and Eintracht Frankfurt murdered them in two games in Germany and Ibrox. So it really did seem a step that was much too far.
Mm. And do you have any vivid memories of Lisbon? Did you get behind the scenes?
Oh yes,
trophy was presented.
Yes. I mean, something that would never happen nowadays because of security. I mean, we actually get into the dressing room at the end, which were almost a kind of cottage type setup. Mm-hmm. And my great memory is of actually seeing Bill Shankly appear at the door, throw his arms up and shout, John, because he always called John, mm-hmm. John, you're immortal.
So you witnessed that?
I actually saw it.
That must have been something to witness.
It's something to cherish, that kind of memory.
Because Shankly was quite a character, of course.
Oh, wonderful, wonderful character. And he and John were very close. Mm. I think possibly a great deal of it was owed because of their shared mining backgrounds.
Mm.
And also they liked to kind of put one up on each other. But to Shankly's eternal credit, he was the only manager from the old English First Division,
the top league,
top league, who went to Lisbon.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that says a lot for him.
Yes.
So through the years, you would have been witness to great personalities at the time. You've touched on Steen and Shankly, and there was Busby, there was Baxter, there was Alec Ferguson, Kenny Dalglish. Who stood out for you through the years? Who were the people that impressed you the most?
Well, Baxter, I ghosted a column for Jim Baxter in Sunday Mirror for two or three years, and in fact I was his best man because he asked
when
he asked me, and I'll better watch what I say here, tone down the reply. But why me, Jim? And instead of that sing-song five acts in hand, because you're the only one I know that can make an effing speech. So that was, and my memory of that is not my part in it, but at the church on Centenary Square, the reception was in the old Centenary Hotel, which is away now.
If I can just come in there, the rent that Bax had owned that at one point, he was never out.
I think it contributed a great deal to this province, but I mean, it was like the Beatles. The square was absolutely mobbed with people just to see, as indeed the church in Coke Bridge when we came out, people just to see him. And rightly, George Best is often named as the kind of fifth Beatle, but I would submit that Jim was ahead of his time there in that. And he wasn't particularly commercially minded. If he had been, he would have ended up with a great deal of money. By the way, two of the guests were Billy McNeil and his wife and Pat Crown. And his
They were great friends.
Yeah, I mean...
Which I don't think we're doing too well at Ibrox, to be honest. So they say.
I don't know. He did with some and not with others. The old guard at Ibrox didn't like him particularly because he kind of ripped up all the traditions that they... although Scott Simon loved him, and Simon was the most traditionalist minded man you could meet, but Jim could do no wrong in Simon's eyes.
It's terribly sad to think back that a talent like Baxter had retired at 29.
Very sad.
You know, very
sad.
You know, to think about the years that he missed it.
I know, I don't know whether it's the Scottish factor, you might say, that so many of the greats through the years, I mean, people I never knew long before my time, like Hughie Gallagher, the Newcastle 94, and Benny Lynch, the boxer. I mean, you could go through.
Self-destruction?
Yes, exactly. It's, whether it's something in the psyche, I don't know.
Baxter was actually a nice guy. I was brought up in Govan. I used to pass by his pub quite a lot.
Oh, yes.
Now, these are the days when pubs, particularly in the Govan area, were wee corner shops.
Yes.
And he had quite a big one with a big lounge, which was really unusual at the time.
Just at Paisley Road Toll.
Paisley Road Toll, and it was a very distinctive pub of the period. And I always remember he used to stand at the door sometimes, and we would pass, we were Celtic fans, obviously, and we would noise him up, and he would give you it back, good nature stuff. But he seemed, for where I stood, he was a real decent guy.
Yes. And then Alec Ferguson had a pub just...
So he had right across the road,
right
Fergie's bar.
Diagonally
And if you even go further down the road, there was Kai Hansen's bar at the Govan Ferry.
I don't remember.
So there was, so within the space of maybe half a mile, three Rangers players of the period having bars in the same place. So, in terms of, you mentioned Baxter, which other personalities stood out for you through the years? Who impressed you?
Well, Steen was the number uno by a mile and a half. And actually, Willie Waddle too, very, very forthright, loved nothing better than an argument on trips. And arguments, by the way, fueled by assistance of a drop of wine or two, but didn't really like going out. Some of us, well, especially the younger ones, would go and try and hit the town. Diddle never did that. He would sit and in the hotel bar till very late, shall we say. And Scott Simon too, I liked a lot. Very shy man, but quite astute underneath the kind of mask. And Jock Steen liked him too.
I mean, the way you're coming across here is it was almost like a friendship you had with my Bond, much more so than journalists I think have these days with players. But you more close to that, do you think?
Yes, it was more of a Bond. Well, for a start, there was a smaller number. When I went to Argentina with Celtic for the World Club Championship, it was only, off the top of my head, I think about six journalists. Now, I think it will happen, but if such an unlikely event did happen again, I mean, you would be still counting at 60.
Yeah,
would be there in today's terms. So there was a small amount. I often think, you know, people say, oh, present day players, do you know so and so, and do you know so and so? You might know them to nod to, or you might know them reasonably well. But I mean, a modern player goes into a press conference, and there's a minimum of 10 to 15 guys sitting. Mm-hmm. It's impossible for them to get to know you. And the clubs do control.
Yeah, the
much,
public relations departments are much more involved, aren't they?
Much more.
Too much, probably.
Oh, far too much. I mean, that is where it is a different game. I mean, just to give you a current example, Aberdeen players, I understand, are under very strict instructions, and no way have they to suggest that they might win the league. Mm-hmm.
Play it down.
So there's a now. Some of them may have some very trenchant, strong views about it, but you'll never read it, and they'll never be allowed to say it.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, that's only one example.
So you mentioned Argentina there.
Yes.
You know, we have to speak about that. And that was a terrible experience. Do you think it's sort of like, that they say that Bob Kelly was never the same after that? It really, his attitude to football had maybe changed at that point?
Well, to be honest, I wasn't aware of that, Stevie. He was a strange character. He was actually not an unlikable character, but he was disliked by a heck of a lot of people. He did believe he was an almighty power where football was concerned in the matter of team selections. He couldn't get past Patsy Gallagher as his hero. He would give you a chapter and verse of moves that Patsy Gallagher made. Now, Patsy Gallagher's 100 years before my time, even. Maybe he was right, I don't know. And some of the things he was right, danger from live television in football, there is a suggestion that there might be allowing live television of English Premiership games on a Saturday afternoon. Well, that happens, they can shut the doors. So they're playing in front of nobody.
I know, it's quite a serious development.
But he was, he was very forthright and didn't broach any arguments.
So what kind of welcome did we get in Argentina?
We went to the I think it's called the place called, if my memory serves me right, the Hindu Country Club. Now, it was a kind of upmarket Butlins, I would say. I think it was a holiday when we got there on the Sunday, because there was families all over the place. There was swimming pool, a golf course, a tennis court, and what have you. I don't remember them being particularly showing any great animosity then, but once we got to the ground, that was a different matter. That made Rangers and Celtic even seem quite mild. Quite mild. Okay, one of the problems, of course, purely from press wise, communications, I mean, this makes me sound like Methuselah, but communications were awful. You couldn't make a direct phone call from Argentina to Britain, or likewise.
So how did you do it?
It was with telex, everything was done by telex. But I remember on the day of the game, my boss in Manchester on the Sunday night phoned me, and I was vaguely able, as I thought, to hear about a smattering of what he was saying, that Scott Simon had been fired by Rangers. And I went in, Jock and Sean Farrell were playing snooker, and I went into this room to tell them, because Jock knew my boss in Manchester, Tony Smith, because of the column that he did for the paper, and obviously he used Scott Simon. and I can see yet, I said this, I see yet Sean banging down his cue and saying, don't come in here on a day of such an important game talking such rubbish. So I had to retreat. Of course, well, unfortunately for Scott Simon, it wasn't rubbish. Mm-hmm. It was
That was quite a shock in its day. So, talking about Jock Stein, that brings us on to you, Ghost wrote his column in the Sunday Mirror. Now, to put people in the loop out there, that my dad used to buy the Sunday Mirror only because Jock Stein had a column in it on a Sunday. Now, my recollection was it was monthly, but you're saying it was more of a weekly thing.
It was a weekly, a Sunday thing.
That would fit in because my dad bought it faithfully every week.
Yes.
And me and him would sit down avidly and read the Jock Stein column to see what Jock had to say. So, how did that come out?
Well, it came about because it was made obvious, shall we say, that after his fairly unsuccessful spell as Scotland team manager the first time round, when he doubled up with Celtic, the Celtic job. And can I just go back here to Bob Kelly to say that he was perceptive in that. He told Jock not to take it, the Scotland job, but he couldn't do both. He was proved right, as Jock subsequently admitted. He wanted to tell his story, and I think it was mostly Sunday papers that were in for it. And we weren't getting all that to first base with it. Anyway, he had gone to Manchester to see a game, and I went down, and we had lunch in the the Midlands Hotel, which was the great football gathering place in Manchester at the time. Sports editor Tony Smith, Sam Leach, who was
the BBC.
Yes, but at that time he was the paper's number one columnist, and myself. And as I say, we were struggling a bit when Eddie Waring came in, the rugby league commentator. Now, Eddie also did a column for the Sunday Mirror, and he sat down and Jock said, "Oh, you're my mother's favourite commentator." And they started, and Eddie said, "Oh, you go to the Sunday Mirror, Jock." And that was really how we clinched it, thanks to Eddie Waring. And so we did, I think it was three or four, I can't remember the series, and it was so successful circulation wise that we started a weekly call, which, if my memory serves me right, began in 1966, and I did it right up until I left the paper in 1983.
That's a long time.
A long time.
My goodness.
And it was, people talk about I did ghostwrite it technically, but it was a pleasure to me. All you did was you stuck a tape recorder and explained to our listeners, you've got a little one here, size of half a 10 cigarette packet. Well, in those days, they were the size of two half bricks put together. And we used to go for lunch to a restaurant called the Vesuvio in Glasgow every Friday. And I stuck this huge thing in front of him, and he went through what he wanted to say. I'd go back and transcribe it, and it was mostly, in fact, it was purely a matter of sticking an introduction on and just the rest just.
So, that's a long, long time. You must have got to him quite intimately.
Yes. Well, without boasting, I did, and I very kindly gave me open access. I could ring his front door bell phone him or ring his front door bell any time, day or night. It was sometimes on a Saturday morning, even if the column had to be changed, I'd quiz round to his house in King's Park in Glasgow.
So the great years of Jock Stein through the years, and you were able to capture that in print, if you like, because he was giving you the exclusives of the time.
So that's for others to make a judgment. I hope I did.
And what I'm trying to say here is that some of the ex-players, particularly John Hughes, have brought books out recently, and they've been a wee bit critical of John, much more so than maybe the earlier books that came out. And they were saying that he'd maybe had an insensitive streak that came out, did you have any inkling of that?
No, I didn't, but I'm not disputing for the likes of what Yogi or others have said, because you can only write or talk about people as you yourself find them, not about how other people find them.
I mean, the whole thing is, I remember there's been documentaries about Shankly and Matt Busby, and, yes. and some players have said similar things about them.
Yes.
So
yes.
I think them being, they must have been under a great deal of pressure for success, and you know, sometimes you can snap under pressure or say things that you maybe regret later
that's,
on.
That's right. Other players. Mm-hmm. I mean, not every pressman loved Jock.
No.
I mean, he could be extremely abrasive. I remember one occasion he signed Tom Callaghan from Dunfermline, and a rather naive reporter said to him at the press conference, "Have you signed him for the first team squad?" And the answer came back, "No, for the office furniture." You know, collapse of the reporter.
So the success that Jockstein had through the year, what do you think was his secret? Was people always talk about his attention to detail or his motivation techniques. What would you put it down to?
Attention to detail, obviously, but I think motivation was a part of it. He also had a journalist's love of nosiness. He just loved to know what was going on. And he stored it all away and used it when it suited him. Now, listen, that doesn't win you trophies, saying that. But I think motivation was the main feature.
Did you see a lot of Alec Ferguson and Jockstein?
Yes, very much.
Sorry, a lot of Jockstein and Alec Ferguson, sorry.
Yes, let us reverse that. Yes, very, very much, yes. If it's a son of Jock in management, it was Ferguson. Yeah. So, Billy Menial too, to a degree.
Yeah. So when you went on these foreign trips abroad and you know, you're talking there about the night spent in the hotels, Jock must have been great company at that point.
Yes. He sat with a pot of tea and stirred that pot literally and metaphorically. He stirred it from his cuppa and he stirred it to throw in remarks or barbs or something that he'd been storing up to get somebody. He mellowed a fair bit. Well, he mellowed after the
car
crash.
Yeah.
And he also mellowed when he became Scotland manager. But he wasn't above.
J2O, please, and a diet coke.
Okay.
He wasn't above using his Machiavellian ways. Even a Scotland manager, one of my colleagues told me a story of he had phoned him on the Sunday about some injury to somebody in the squad, and the press for some reason were travelling apart from the team, and they got out and they were sitting at a bar about midnight, and somebody said, "Oh, I fancy Joe Bloggs pulling out." And the guy said, "Oh, how did that come about?" He says, "Well, I phoned the big man this afternoon and he told me." The big man had been annoyed by something this writer had written earlier, and this was his revenge. It wasn't a matter of revenge, but it was just one way of saying, just remember who the boss is.
Put him in his place.
Yeah.
Were you in Madrid in 74? Atletico Madrid?
Yes.
That must have been an experience also.
That was one of the best experiences, yes. The famous time of, Jimmy was...
death threats and God
yes,
himself.
That's right. But I told a joke, and he tried to get Jimmy around by saying, "Well, at least you can move about in the park. I'm stuck in one position."
I'm a sitting target.
A sitting target, yeah.
So
that was
Kira.
That was a horrible experience, really. That one.
They reckon that was Celtic's last. The last of the great days. That this was the semi final of the European Cup.
Yes.
And after that, they were never quite the force that they were previously.
No.
Although it's interesting to think that there's a friend and I often have a wee sort of debate that there was two semi finals within 3 years. And the first one we lost in penalties to Inter Milan, which I'm sure you remember.
Yes.
Now, if they'd have won that one, we'd have played Ajax in the final. Now, as much as I'm Celtic mad, I don't think we could have beaten Cruyff's team at that point. But I do think we could have had a go at Bayern Munich in 74.
Mm-hmm.
And that would have been a fascinating outcome to see that Beckenbauer and Gerd Müller and these great players of the period.
Isn't it fantastic to think of two semi-finals in 3 years?
Glasgow,
if a team got to one semi-final, 10 years, any Scottish team, Celtic or whoever.
Mm-hmm. But you sort of took it for granted back then.
Yes, I think we did. Indeed, you could apply it across the board to an extent. The international teams, you think 74, 78, 82, 86, 90.
Well, how many World Cups would you have been to then?
Well, the first one I did, believe it or not, was 66.
Oh, well, it's only down the road.
I guess, yeah. I was at Wembley.
So were you there for the final?
Yes.
Oh. Who were you cheering that day?
Well, I was working, so I...
Yeah, yeah.
But I do recall when the Germans scored their equaliser almost on full time.
Yeah.
Pushed the match into extra time. Ken Gallagher and Hugh Taylor were the record, standing up embracing one another. So they were making it quite clear who they wanted to win.
And so after that, what other World Cups would you have got to then?
74. So 74 in West Germany, which was the best.
Mm-hmm.
78 in Argentina, which was the best for stories.
Yeah.
82 in Spain, 86 in Mexico, 90 in Italy, we didn't make 94, and 98 in France.
So it's been a hard life then, Roger. I have to ask you about Argentina. The reason why I ask it this is that I remember the 74 World Cup as a kid, and I really enjoyed it, and I was excited.
You don't look old enough.
Well, the thing about 78 was that maybe being a boy, and I think I was 12 or 13 at the time, and maybe as a boy you tend to get caught up in a wee bit more, but I think everybody did. I mean, we were quoted as one of the favourites, and kids these days, my son is 10, and he would never believe that there's a World Cup that we went into thinking that we might not win the thing, but we might get to the semi-finals.
Yeah.
And the annoying thing is they were a good team at the time.
Indeed.
They had great players.
Indeed. I think it was a combination of factors that we didn't do well. Alan McLeod was a lovely man. He was a smashing guy. You got a pint with him quite happily. And as a club manager, he certainly wasn't the worst. He did a lot for Air United. Took Aberdeen to a League Cup victory over Celtic. But I think international team was just a step too far for him. He wasn't a great one for believing in detail, so he never went to look at Peru or Iran. And the events absolutely engulfed him. Now, that's not to say that the events wouldn't have engulfed greater managers than Ali.
Mm-hmm.
But you can only go by what did happen. One of my memories of that one is the press headquarters were a place called the Jockey Club in Cordoba.
Mm-hmm.
And the night after the defeat from Peru, the first game, we were all sitting in this rather elegant dining room with white gloved waiters and wood panelling.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't called the Jockey Club for nothing.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think there's a bit of Argentina society, without getting too deep into it, which is really pretty well healed,
yeah.
And they copied.
Very Anglified. Yeah.
Exactly, they copied English style.
Mm-hmm.
And anyway, we're all sitting there, and a German journalist went by and he said, "Have you heard the news about your player being found guilty of taking drugs, and nobody bothered, kind of, this guy's had too many schnapps or something like that. And then he went into detail. Well, I've never seen a table empty, so it was something like a Marx Brothers movie. People just up from the table and running to try and get confirmation. And then, of course, it was telex, and you couldn't, as I said, you couldn't.
So, forgive my ignorance, but telex, is that typing or is that what?
Yes, no, it's typing. It's a kind of teletype thing, yeah. You know. I don't know if they still use it, probably not. So everybody, and that was that was quite late on. So they must have had a heck of a job back in Glasgow to change the papers. But I think they did find a way of doing it.
And the failure in Argentina, would you put it down to Ali's failings, or was it the reckon that some of the players were less than professional, shall we say?
I don't know. Everything became, it became very difficult to separate fact from fiction. The Scottish media have the noise criticism enough, but I mean, the Argentinian media, what they did was they were going to a bar and they would see some of the Tartan Army with Scottish strips on, and they would then run stories that Scottish players were drinking en masse. And no doubt there were odd occasions when they did sneak out. Because it was a pretty closed atmosphere. It was a very surprising choice, because again, if we're talking about attention to detail, Ernie Walker was the secretary of the SFA at the time, and he was a stickler for detail, and he had gone to see it, he and Ali, after the draw. I don't know what possessed them to pick that particular. It was an Alta Gracia. I think it was called the Tel Sierra, but it doesn't matter. But the whole thing just became an absolute nightmare. Ali stuck to the team that he believed to be the best. But I mean, somebody like Graham Souness should have been brought in for the Iran game. He was eventually for the victory. The Holland game. He should have been in the four.
I think where Ali became very unfortunate was if that tournament had been 12 months previously, then guys like Don Madison and Bruce Rioch and Willie Johnson were probably at their peak.
Yes.
But 12 exactly. months later, they were the firing
on all
cylinders
right.
at that time.
He maybe if he had a fault, he was too loyal to players like that. And
another thing that people fail to understand is Danny McGrain and Gordon McQueen were arguably the two best players
right.
in their own positions in Europe at the time,
right.
and he lost both of them through injury. There's not many teams could cope with that.
And I think Willie Donaghy was injured as well.
He was suspended, I think, for the first game.
Was he? Danny and Gordon McQueen were big losses. And of course, what was always hung round his neck was when he said, "We will win the World Cup." Now, he actually never did say this, but what he did say was, and this goes back to the draw, which was in January
78,
and he and Ernie Walker came back from Buenos Aires, and by luck or ill luck, there was almost a wipeout of fixtures of the top league in Scotland that Saturday. So Sunday papers are left with acres to fill. So we all dive down British Caledonian to Gatwick and taken into a lounge, and Ali and Ernie were brought in and we filled our boots with cotton coffee. But what he did say was, "We could come back with a medal." Now that,
then
you could finish one,
fourth.
Two, or
three.
And but this, as the time went on, this was embellished and translated in tabloid ease as "We will win," which he didn't. Obviously.
It's a shame, because Ali's always remembered as a bit of an unfortunate character. And
that's right. He he had very good ideas. Nothing to do with, I'm not talking on the part, I don't really know what he was like as a tactician, but when he was manager of Ayr United, he used to hold press conferences on a Friday in the Glasgow Press Con. Mm-hmm. So he ensured he got, because people couldn't get down to Ayr to spend a whole day Ayr, he came up to them, and that ensured he got more publicity than almost any lower league, any other lower league club. Now, that doesn't make you a World Cup winning manager, but what I'm saying was that he wasn't an old-fashioned manager, and he did have ideas. Tactically, I don't think he was brilliant, but and his attention to detail also left a lot to
And yeah, these were great days for the Scottish national team. 100,000 crowds at Hampden.
Yes.
The night we played Wales at Anfield.
Yes.
And it was a 50,000 crowd, and it's estimated 40,000 Scots fans were there.
That's right.
And we filled the Welsh end.
That's right.
And you just kind of get your head around that now. Even at Wembley, when 75,000-80,000 of the crowd are Scotsmen.
And I think it's worth remembering that right up until the actual World Cup, he delivered most of what he had said he would. Not all.
Yeah.
No manager can do that. Not even Jock Steen. But he did deliver. The record was pretty good. And it was so upbeat, as you know, that the atmosphere in the country.
It's euphoria, to be frank.
Exactly.
You know, it was unbelievably.
That's why every manager since then, led by Steve, have kind of downplayed expectations. And when Craig Levein rather stupidly said that we would win every game in our qualifying section for the 2012, was it? It backfired on him big time.
At least Ali can point to the likes of Archie Gemmell and Kenny Dalglish. I'm afraid poor Craig didn't quite have that to work with.
No, that's true. No, again, you could look always at football or any sport with rose-coloured spectacles, and the past is always greater. I don't think it is in every aspect, but there's no doubt about it. These Scottish teams from 60 through to about 2000, they did have some great players. Although, even with great players, the team in the 60s, which had arguably the best group of players of all of them,
underachieved,
never made it to the World Cup final. You know, to 66 or 70 or 62 for that matter.
It's worthwhile pointing out, though, they only won qualified from the group in those days.
Yes,
and we were coming up against the likes of Italy and Mestierni, who were really big hitters.
Yeah, but we did well. We should have qualified in 66, and we got to the playoff for the
62
when Czechoslovakia, who went on to be beaten finalists, beat us in the playoff in the high zone.
So that brings us on a wee bit then.
Yes.
You are fondly remembered by Celtic fans. And the reason for that being that you edited the Playing for Celtic books between 1969 and 1989, a total of 21 years.
Right.
Now, there's many of us, and I'm speaking personally here, who it wasn't really a proper Christmas unless Santa brought us the Playing for Celtic books. They were wonderful publications of the period. And I think I'm correct in saying that they were successful. And,
yes, they were.
Because everybody, certainly all the kids I knew wanted one.
Yes.
Now, you did the Playing for Celtic books, Ken Gallagher did the Playing for Rangers, and Hugh Taylor did the Scotland books.
That's right.
And every year, when your mammy went into John Menzies or whatever the bookshop it was in the days, Stanley Paul's books were there and big adverts. And they were, so how did that come about? How did your involvement in that start?
It came about because, really through Hugh Taylor. Kenny Gallagher and I were kind of proteges of his, myself first and then Kenny, because he was sports editor of the Record. And they decided to, Stanley Paul, the publishers, as you say, decided to expand it. And Hughie, I think, put us forward for I must say I thoroughly enjoyed doing it. They were easy to write in the sense that during almost all of that time, Celtic enjoyed an amazing dominance in Scottish football. So you were writing about success, which was the great thing. Talking about how well they sold, I remember the manager of Woolworths on Argyle Street telling Kenny and I we were there for some promotion thing. It was the most shoplifted books in the store.
They were locking it.
We more or less locked away, or somebody had to keep a special eye on them. They were rather prone to walking. But anyway, the publishers, I suppose, chancing their arm at the time, didn't actually pay Celtic any royalties for it.
Uh-huh.
And of course, when we got to the late 80s, and it was a much more commercial orientated business. In fact, Rangers had kind of sorted out earlier, and they had it was stopped, and they took over their own thing, and Celtic took over. Sorry, Celtic fallen. And I must say, I was getting to the stage where I wasn't upset about it because a guy called Terry Cassidy.
The infamous Terry Cassidy.
Thank you. Terry Cassidy was the chief executive of the club, and I didn't fancy. Not that I worked with the club office bearers, officials as such, but I did have a reasonable relationship with them. I didn't fancy. I didn't like the man. Didn't regard him at all. And I thought I could only see pitfalls in any future relationship. So, although it was the club who took the decision to pull the book, I can't quite remember if it was him or before him. I wasn't too bothered, actually.
I had the dubious pleasure of attending a meeting with Terry Cassidy, and he told us that the club was bringing out a new away strip now Celtic. If it had yellow, if it had black, if it had green and black stripes, if it had bumblebee stops, it had a whole variety of colours and shapes and sizes. And in all innocence, I asked them, what colour would it be? I didn't think that was, what colour is it? And his reply was, royal effing blue. And that was the kind of man you were dealing with. He was very brusque.
Bryce, beyond the point of rudeness.
And the only satisfaction I take with the whole thing is that my friend and I, when we left the meeting, told him that he was being used by the board, and as soon as he was out of usefulness, he all out the door, and sure enough, six months later, he was shown the door. So that was that. But when the first one came out in 1969, did you see it lasting 21 years, though?
No.
Because it was a long, long time.
No, it's like... somebody, not to put it in too high a pedestal, but it's like a film is made and somebody says then we'll have a sequel, and you maybe have four or five, but to go 21 years, I suppose it is quite an achievement. I still have them all.
Believe it or not, I have as well. Many of us have, yeah.
I still use them occasionally for research purposes.
Yeah, yeah.
They're quite handy.
The thing I would say is as well, they were obviously aimed at the kids' market, maybe the teenage market. But I mean, speaking as somebody who was in his 20s at the time, I still wanted them for Christmas as a present. even at a fairly late age. And my dad would read it as well, so it was something that the whole family could enjoy.
Even when you stopped believing in Santa Claus.
Well, he still came. But they were a good publication, there was great photographs, and as time went on a wee bit, the colour photographs began to come in.
That's
so
right.
You saw a change in
yes.
society as well,
that's
when
right.
the colour printing
right.
came in.
In the first one, I think only I was quite intrigued. I went with my son and two-year-old grandson to the Hampden Museum recently, and there's a display of books. I was quite pleased to see some of them, or not all of them.
Granders was there.
Are in there.
The thing that made the book so interesting was you get this was a time of when you didn't get any great exposure in the press for players. You know, you get a wee bit, but yes, nothing in the scale you get these days. And in your book, you were learning a wee bit more about certain players.
Yes.
And you always had a chapter in it that fascinated me. It was always about the backroom guys. It was maybe by the...
Yes, Neil Morgan.
Even more so than... I remember you did one about the film club, you did one about the Celtic Pools, you did one about the women behind the scenes who washed the strips and the groundsmen who cut the grass.
Yes.
I mean, there was a focus in every single aspect of the club, and you were in great detail.
It was just, as I say, it was to try and give people a wider aspect, just a kind of laundry list of results and scores.
Mm-hmm.
Although that was in it as well. George Dean Jock's son used to, despite my best efforts, I think in some of them there were factual errors in that. And George was a great one. I mean, he was only a teenager at the time, for going through and pointing them out. Of course, by that time, the blessed boot was printed. So.
But maybe didn't have spell check in those days either. You know,
No. I like to think the spelling wasn't too bad, but of course, again, it was so much easier now because you're sat with a computer and those days you had to batter it out on the typewriter. And if you wanted to go back and perhaps rephrase a sentence or something, it depended what kind of mood you were in, you know, if you could be bothered to do that.
So then, the book finished, as you say, then the Celtic have an annual that they bring out now, and my boy gets it, and honestly, he's 10 and he's outgrown it.
Uh-huh.
And really, what they replaced it with was quite frankly an insult to your intelligence. So
I've seen it, I've seen it in the show. I think there's a Rangers of a similar one.
That's right, it must be the same printers they use.
Yes. Uh-huh. As you say, it was to try and it basically was aimed at children. The original playing for Celtics, but you like to think that you were perhaps it could be enjoyed by people who weren't 7 or 8, you know. And also by the very fact that it is an official imprint, I mean, no whiff of criticism can be put into it. You know?
No, you had to paint it fairly, even when it was a bad result.
So I like to think that we could, without being overcritical, could at least point out problems at times.
Mm-hmm. And on the subject of books, did you ghostwrite any books for any of the players of the period?
No.
No, because I know some of the journalists used to get a wee earner out of that kind of thing.
Yes. Uh-huh. Well, during that time with the playing for Celtic, I wouldn't have taken on another one. I'm not saying it was the hardest job, but it was, in its own way, fairly time-consuming, you know. And especially when I went back to the record in 1983 from the Sunday Mirror. I mean, daily papers, I don't want to sound as if I'm looking for violins to play in the background, but daily papers, it is a fairly demanding job. Yeah. As your friend.
Yes, as your mutual friend, that's right.
Yeah.
So looking back on it, like, certainly but when I was a kid and I was growing up, there was guys like Jimmy Sanderson, Alec Cameron, Ian Archer, Alan Davidson, and who was the other guy who used to... you mentioned Hugh Taylor and people like that as well, Ken Gallagher.
Yes.
These guys were characters themselves.
Yes.
And when you read their match reports, their characters come out in it.
Yes.
Somewhat.
I am not critical of modern day journalists because, despite I know fans won't agree, but it is a demanding job. One thing that the style of present day reports, I think it lends itself too much to players' quotes. Mm-hmm. Now, this is, as I gather from, say, the 30s, there was no quotes. Players weren't mm-hmm. quoted at all. There was a guy called Arthur Christensen, who was a legendary editor of the Daily Express in his heyday. He introduced it pre-war and post-war. But of course, now it's become the elephant in the room. The writer really doesn't get a chance to express his views, or they don't express it enough. Now, whether that's by design or choice, I don't know. Where I think the present day writers are incomparably better than even some of the great names you've mentioned, the number of words that they've got to churn out.
Yeah.
And file, especially on foreign trips.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, these are these can be pretty stomach-churning nights.
Mm-hmm. I mean, back in the old days, the Daily Sunday Mail, for example, would have had maybe four or five sports pages, and these days they've got maybe 10 pages at the back, and they've got the pull-out spread in the middle.
Yes.
As does the Record and the Sun on a Saturday, and that is a lot of space.
Saturday,
different.
Sunday, Monday, you know. Mm-hmm. Yes. Massive amount of words. So maybe there are reasons why the quotes are given such prominence. Because it's a heck of a lot of words. It's actually a heck of a lot of space to fill.
But the one criticism I've got at the modern day reporters is that in the old days, I think the likes of yourselves reported what was happening and let the reader make their mind up. You reported the facts and you described what was happening. But these days, I think there's too many guys that have got I hesitate to say an agenda, I don't want to be cynical, but they've got an opinion, and it's their opinion that they're putting out.
Yes, perhaps.
And I think that's something that I don't like too much in the modern age.
Perhaps. But then, it's an opinion age, isn't it? I mean,
social networks.
I mean, people will say to me, players will say to me, Bertie Auld's always on about this to me. And your day, he didn't report on what was going on. And I say, Bertie, going to a Celtic website or a Rangers website, fans website, and you'll read a player. I saw that Joe Snokes in Tesco buying a bottle of vodka.
That's right.
Yeah, you know, it's an entirely different. If a player,
it's a goldfish mentality these days.
Exactly. If a player blows his nose, it's news according to these websites. And that's where it's changed utterly. Before, perhaps, you could use some, shall we say, judgment in, I suppose you might say, suppressing or playing down still. Can't do that nowadays.
No, everything that I think about, that's right.
So if you don't use it,
somebody else will.
Oh, Twitter will use it.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. What I was going to say there was that there's a story I read, I'm trying to remember where I read this fairly recently, that Jimmy Sanderson, who was a bit of a boxer in his day,
indeed,
and he knocked out Peter Lorenzo with one punch, apparently. Is this true?
That's right. It was we were coming back from Argentina in 60.
The Celtic
trip. And the whole thing had kind of degenerated into chaos. And there was problems with the flight back. And we ended up kind of more or less tipping on the floor of Buenos Aires Airport, a lounge or something there. And a few sherbets had been taken by then. And I don't know if he actually knocked him out, but there was certainly punches swung. Lorenzo.
He would have been there reporting for the English papers.
He was there for the Daily Herald, which at the time. I think he and J.L. Manning of the Daily Mail were the only two.
Who weren't noted for their disposition towards Scotland or the fans.
Precisely. I don't think Manning was there, but Lorenzo certainly was. And there was a bit of antipathy because Douglas Ritchie, the Scottish guy of the Daily Herald, had got on the trip. They decided to send Lorenzo.
English guy.
English guy. And one thing led to another, there was a swift altercation, which I seem to remember the Celtic manager breaking up. Oh, spectacular.
Looking back at it, you must have had a great sort of, it must have been a great experience, like going with these guys. You must have been fairly close, although you've got a rivalry in terms of circulation.
Oh yes, that's right. Yes,
but you were friends and as professionals.
Yes, to an extent. But it's like any bunch of people, I imagine, in any job. It's a bit cliquey, isn't it? You know, some people go on with some other people better than they
human do nature.
With human nature. Yeah. But on the whole, yes. Yeah.
Would you have been there the night that Billy McNeely's fought with Jeremy E?
No, I wasn't.
Because I always think that's a sort of like a watershed in the relationship between players and the press, because up to that point, it was a fairly mutual admiration for each other, respect.
That's right. Yes. No, I wasn't. I can't remember why. I do know why. I was number two to Alec Cameron by then on the record. Mm-hmm. And Alec was in the trip. Mm-hmm. I can't remember who it's Celtic were playing.
It was a European game.
I
think it was Polytechnic in Romania.
And there was an overnight stay in London.
That's right. We're all coming out.
Yes. Great punch-ups.
So my recollection, when you were on the record, you tended to do the Celtic games. Hugh Taylor did the Rangers games. Wallace Moore did Dundee United and Ian Brodie did Aberdeen.
That's right.
And when all these foreign trips came about, you always seem to get the Celtic one. Would that be right?
I suppose so. Well, I wasn't there on the record when Hugh Taylor was there. I was originally way back in the 60s, but not later.
Maybe it was Alec Cameron.
It was Alec Cameron, yes. Yes, to an extent. And also the start of two men covering was coming in. In other words, if the game was important enough, both Alec and I would be sent. Now that's a new development. It's not new, it's probably been in place for about 30 years, but until then it was one writer, one club, you know, whereas now all the top people send two, principally because the job is it's very time consuming. You know, your match report needs to zip down for quotes and whatnot, and you've always the thought that the plane is leaving an hour or so after the game.
Well, we were reminiscing before we started talking, and we were saying that Celtic's fancy press box that was built in the 70s was a wonderful thing for the press corps back in the day.
Oh, it was. One of the...
But safe to say, it's now an executive box, courtesy of Fergus McCann.
Yes. One of the stories I remember about that was Jock McVicar, who is still writing for the Express, by the way, and he's older than me. Jock's father, Angus McVicar, was a very famous author, and he had taken him along one day. We were up in the cabin in the sky, and Jock said to his dad, "Would you like a piece of cake, Father?" And he said yes. His father said yes. And the press box steward, assuming that this was a priest, plied him with goodies for the rest of the day. You'll have another
because
cup
he said
of
father.
Tea. Yes, you'll have another cup of tea, Father. Another piece of cake, Father.
He was in the right place. Good job he wasn't at Ibrox at that time.
Exactly.
That would have been fun.
Exactly.
So it would have. And the old, we have to mention as well, the old Hampden press box, which to me is a boil at any given time, as if it was just going to crumble and fall.
As if it was going to slide into the thing. And yet, it was the best view in football and the best acoustics. You could actually put the windows, you could put the windows up and you could actually hear in a crowd of hundreds you know, you actually hear, not every word, you could hear what players were shouting to one another. It was unbelievable, that. And it was great because after every two seats there was a gap. A lot of press boxes, even now, I mean, if somebody's wanting to get out at the far end, it's like a cinema, you just squeeze along, and you didn't at Hampden. It was very good.
So just in closing then, I know time's getting on a wee bit, there was a wee bit of debate some time ago, who was the great Scottish player of all time, and generally it comes down to Dennis Law or Kenny Dalglish. So as a man who saw both of them at their peak, and saw their greatest days, in your own mind, who would your choice be?
Well, obviously it's a difficult question, which gives me time to think. I prefer Dennis myself, because purely because he was the goal scorer supreme. On the other hand, you can say Kenny had more, because not only was he a goal scorer, but he could make goals and whatnot. But maybe because I was younger when I watched Dennis at first, he always excited me, really, as a player. I thought he was something special.
So that brings us to the end, Roger. I want to thank you for your time. It's really, really enjoyed this, and I wish you all the best for the future.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Walk out to winter.
Swear I'll be there. Well, where else would you interview a journalist if not in a pub? Hope you enjoyed that. There will definitely be more podcasts along soon, and hopefully at the speed of production that the last three or four over the Christmas and New Year period have been. If you're living in and around Scotland at the moment, I hope you're enjoying the snow. As I've said on Twitter, never trust an adult who says they don't like snow and they call it bad weather. They've obviously lost touch with their inner child. Health reasons for giving. This is me, Harry Brady, saying, I'm on the hoops. God bless. Good night. Good night.